Well, hey, good morning. My name is Shane, and I get to be one of the pastors here on staff at Washington Avenue Christian Church, where real people experience real grace. And we are so excited that you have chosen to worship with us this morning. So I'm going to be honest with you guys for just a moment, if I can. I have really awesome kids, and I'm not even shy about saying that. And you guys are really gracious and really generous, and almost every time that I preach, and a lot of weeks in between, I get at least one of you comes up to me and says, "Shane, why don't you show us pictures of your children?" And you know, it's kind of this awkward place for me, because I don't want to just like platform them, and I don't want to abuse this spot and bring attention to them or myself unnecessarily. But I figured it's been a little bit, and can I this morning show you guys some pictures of our cute children? That's a very resounding yes. All right, Isaac, go ahead, man. Thank you. Oh my goodness, Isaac, is the projector working? I saw you ordered some lamps for the projector. Is it? Well, I sent him a couple. Maybe the next one will be okay. Ah! What in the world? Maybe they downloaded poorly or something. I don't know. Oh, gosh. Try the rest of them, man. I don't know. Okay. Well, darn. Oh, goodness gracious. That's just like nightmare fuel. Okay. Here's the honest truth. Can I tell you why I showed you those pictures? It's because I've been noticing some of you guys falling asleep. And I thought, if I scare them, they won't fall asleep anymore. No, just kidding. That's not it. So, back in the day, and you guys will understand this, my wife and I are photographers. It's what we do, in spite of what you see behind me. Back in the day, you used to have to, take your pictures and then pull the film out, right? And you'd take it, and you'd have to wait like a week to figure out how terrible your pictures were, right? And then you would open them up to much disappointment and blurriness and all of those things. But inside of the pictures, right, or not inside of the pictures, but inside the little envelope, the packet, there's this little brown part, right? It's called the negative. You ever hold those up to the light? They look like that. It's kind of terrifying, right? Because negatives are creepy, right? We don't want to see the negatives. We want to see the real image. Would you guys like to see the real images? I did bring those. Here you go. There you go. There they are. So this is my wife and our two kids. Janessa's going to be 4 in September. Corbin just turned 1. This was a Mother's Day shoot. You can kind of click through the rest of those real quick, Isaac, just like relieve these people. So Corbin just turned 1. We did a photo shoot with him. That's my truck that my dad and I restored. And I brought him home from the hospital in that, so that was a fun little moment for us to have. And there's just some more, my cute wife and boy, and then the little Janessa is, she's in there somewhere too, in the next one, yeah. There's a lot of Corbin pictures, I didn't realize how many I did. I was just kind of going for the creepiest ones I could find, you know what I mean? There's my pretty girls, so cool. So negatives are creepy, right? Like you look at those and you're like, man, that looks great, but the negative those, oh, not so much. Well, this morning we're continuing in the series called Broken Saviors through the book of Judges. And this morning together we're going to experience some things that have never happened in the book of Judges before. And what I mean by that is that there's been a pretty consistent pattern in the book of Judges so far. And here's what the pattern is. The people stink. They're awful. They're terrible. They descend into the cycle of sin, and after a period of time, usually because a foreign nation is oppressing them, they begin to cry out to the Lord for help, and God picks a judge and raises them up and leads the people out of oppression and restores them into their relationship with God. And then after the judge dies, then the cycle begins again, because the people begin to worship other idols. And then they're oppressed by other nations, and the cycle begins again. And that's been the pattern so far. But this morning, we're going to break that pattern just a little bit. We're still looking at the life of Gideon.
And in the judges that we've dealt with up until this point, it's like their victory is won, the enemy is overthrown, and the judge dies, and we move on. For the first time here, the author of the book of Judges, who's probably Samuel, in case you were curious, the guy who wrote 1 and 2 Samuel, some people think he was the last judge, some people define him as the first prophet, he's probably somewhere in the middle of that. Samuel is probably writing this, and he decides that we're going to linger in the life of Gideon just a little bit, because there is more to tell. And we see two things in the life of Gideon that have yet to happen or have never happened in the book of Judges up until this point. The first one is this, is that the people begin their backslide into sin during rather than after the life of the judge, right? So usually while the judge is ruling and reigning, things are good, and it's after the judge dies that the backslide begins, but not so here. Here in the life of Gideon, the people begin their backsliding under Gideon's leadership. And for the first time, we are really made aware of the flaws of the judge himself. Like, yes, I know, like, all of the judges up until this point and all of the judges after this also, they're human. And so, like, we know and understand innately that they have flaws. But for the first time, we're shown the flaws of Gideon and the judge. And I had to remind myself of this multiple times this week. It was very disappointing for me as I cracked the text to begin to prepare for this, but I had to remind myself that this series is called Broken Saviors. Broken Saviors, which means that there are no happy endings in Judges. Zero. Zero happy endings. I was blindly hoping for a happy ending for Gideon, or that at least that Gideon's brokenness was experienced by us. It was made manifest to us in chapter 6 before his calling or during his calling when he's consistently providing the angel of the Lord Jesus and God the Father and also God the Holy Spirit, right? This triune experience. He consistently asks for more signs and more confirmation that he's being called to the thing that he's being called to. I thought that was the brokenness of Gideon that we were dealing with, and that after chapter 6, that everything was going to be going great. Unfortunately, that's not the case. We've got a lot to deal with this morning. I'm assigned this morning to preach from chapter 8, verse 1, to chapter 10, verse 6. Right? The good news is that I'm not going to do that, okay? That's a lot to cover, and I'll kind of summarize some things for you, and then I'm going to assign you to go ahead and read the text if you want to, because there's a lot there. We're just going to kind of summarize, and then I'll get a setup for next week. But as we dive in this morning, I want to remind you of something that's going on here that could maybe be missed and be a little bit challenging for us to see if we're not made aware of it, all right? I didn't necessarily notice this until I was doing some reading and some studying and some commentaries on my own. So here's the thing, is that we need to understand that this story of the life of Gideon is intended or meant to be typological in nature, right? So we're dealing in typology here. Does that word sound familiar to anybody at all? Typology? Nobody at all. That's okay. I'm going to tell you what it is. So by typology, what I mean is this. That this story points to another story, right? That this story prefigures and points us to a different story that's coming later on. And specifically, this story points to the life of Jesus. As a prefigure, it looks forward to a correspondence in the future. And usually, typology operates in opposites, right? So typology is going to say that this looks like that, but the opposite, right? And you'll see what I mean as we dive in. Let me encourage you to open your text to chapter 8 of Judges. We'll begin there together. In chapter 8, it says this. Remember that Gideon has just gathered the 300, right? The 300 people, and they have, by the power of God and the confusion that he's set within the Midianite camp, the Midianites began to fight themselves, and they won a victory without ever having, they didn't even bring swords to the battle with them or anything. They just like yelled and screamed and blew their trumpets and lit their torches on fire, and the Midianites went crazy and killed each other. and then they ran, right? So we're picking up immediately after that in chapter 8. It says, then the people of Ephraim, they asked Gideon, why have you treated us this way? Why didn't you send for us when you first went out to fight the Midianites? And they argued heatedly with Gideon. Now remember that initially, Gideon had gathered a group of people. It's never once referred to as an army, just gathered the people. And the amount of people that he gathered was 32,000 people. And God said, yo, that is a huge army and way too big for my purposes. And so he pares the army down from 32,000 to 10,000 to 300. Because he says, if 32,000 people go fight the Midianites, Israel will get it in their own heads. They will believe of themselves that they won the battle themselves, and they will give glory and honor to themselves, not to me, God. So he pairs them down from 32,000 to 300. The Ephraimites, which is a nation of Israel, a tribe of Israel within the nation of Israel, they come to Gideon afterwards, and they're like, yo, why didn't you invite us to the battle? Which gives us a clue that they're wanting the glory that comes from battle, right? Which proves God right, that the very thing that God was protecting them from, they are falling susceptible to, even with only 300 people having fought the battle. And what's even more interesting is this. If you'll jump right up to verse 24 of chapter 7, it says this, Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim saying, come down to attack the Midianites. Cut them off at the shallow crossings of the Jordan River at Beth Barah. So all the men of Ephraim did as they were told. They, the men of Ephraim, captured Oreb and Zeb, the two Midianite commanders. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb and Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. And they continued to chase the Midianites. Who? The Ephraimites. So just to be clear, after the army scatters, Gideon puts out word to the entire nation of Israel, the army's on the run, I need your help. The men of Ephraim respond. They join the chase. In joining the chase, they capture either the commanders or the princes. The text is ambiguous, but either way, big guys, right? Big shot guys. The Ephraimite men capture them and kill them. And then they go to Ephraim or to Gideon and say, why didn't you invite us to the battle? He says, well, yeah, I did. I love what Gideon says. Gideon replied, what have I accomplished compared to you? Aren't even the leftover grapes of Ephraim's harvest better than the entire crop of my little clan? God gave you victory over Oreb and Zeb, the commanders of the Midianite army. What have I accomplished compared to that? Then the men of Ephraim heard Gideon's answer and their anger subsided. So Gideon's basically like, hey, guys, like, I know that you're frustrated, like I didn't invite you to the battle, even though I definitely did. You guys did all the hard work, right? You chased the Midianites down. You captured their commanders. Look, I'm just Gideon, man, and all I did was, you know, risk my life by sneaking into the camp to analyze and make sure that everything was good, where I heard about a dream that God had given the Midianites, and it was there that I knew that we were getting the victory, and so I gathered the troops, and I developed the battle plan, and I told them what to do and exactly how to do it, and it was on my command that they, you know, smashed their pots and lit their torches and blew their trumpets and yelled and screamed and that we scattered them. But you guys did all of the hard work, right? You guys are the ones who chased them down and you guys are the ones that captured and killed them. I didn't really do very much at all. Which reminds me, in some ways, of Jesus. Because Jesus did all the hard work for us, right? Jesus did everything for us. He was born to a poor teenage virgin girl who wasn't even married yet, and and before he was even a year old, had to flee for his life to Egypt, where he lived until he was a young child, and then he moved back and was raised by a carpenter and living within this tension of like kind of understanding who he was, but not yet fully understanding who he was, and then being raised up and beginning his ministry, where he traveled around and was homeless and just kind of lived off the support of people, and he began to preach and proclaim this good news of the kingdom. And this good news of the kingdom, people began buying into, and these crowds began to grow. And you know, he is doing miracles, he's casting out demons, he's healing people and all of these things. And his reward for all of that is that he's betrayed by one of his best friends. And he's arrested, and he's beaten, and he's hung on a cross, and he dies, and 3 years, 3 days, not years, 3 days later, he walks out of a tomb alive again. And for all of that, we get to be in a restored relationship with God. Literally, all we have to do is say, yeah, I believe he did that. Jesus did all of the work, all of the hard work, and we are the ones that reap all of the benefits. I love Gideon's response, because Gideon's gracious response to the Ephraimites looks a whole lot like Jesus. And I wish that I could end the sermon right there. Like, we could go grab some breakfast, we could drink some coffee, we could talk about how great Gideon was. Unfortunately, that's not the case. In verse 4 of chapter 8, it says this: Gideon crossed the Jordan with 300 men, and though exhausted, they continued to chase the enemy. And when they reached Succoth, Gideon asked the leaders of the town, "Please give my warriors some food. We are very tired. I am chasing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." I won't read the rest of the text for you. I'll just kind of summarize it. So just to be clear, like, Gideon's still chasing down, because while we've got the princes, the commanders, Oreb and Zeb, they're handled, taken care of, the kings are still free and loose. And while the kings are free and loose, well, anything can happen. And the power is still there. And so Gideon knows, I got to get the kings. He's tired. They've been chasing these guys for a long time. We don't know how long of a time it is. He comes to this town, Succoth, which is in the nation of Israel. Remember, like, these, it's not that these are foreigners. This is literally like his brethren, his tribesmen, his people that he is leading. And he goes to them and says, "Hey, my troops are tired. Can we have some bread?" And Succoth is like, "We only deal with winners. So yeah, you can have some bread once you've won the battle. Once you've won the victory and actually defeated the kings, I forget their names, Zeba and Zalmunna, once you get those guys, yeah, we'll throw you a big feast. But until then, no food for you." Gideon's like, "Okay, all right." He's like, "I'll bring them back. I'll bring those kings back. And when I bring them back, I'm also going to bring with me thorny brambles and bushes, and I'm going to beat you with them." Okay? He goes to the next town, Peniel. And Peniel is famous for this big tower, this huge tower wherein the people liked to gather and throw parties and also would, you know, survey the land and keep watch. So he approaches Peniel. He's like, "Hey, there's only 300 of us. You're a big town. I know that it's asking maybe a little bit, but we're like, we are so hungry. Can we have some bread?" And Peniel says, "We only serve victors here. So why don't you bring back the bodies of the kings and we'll throw you a big feast? But until then, the job's not done. You're not getting our food." Gideon says, "Okay, I'll bring them back. That tower of yours, it's coming down. And everybody in it is going to die." And to make a long story medium length, Gideon chases these fools down and he captures them, Zeba and Zalmunna. And in capturing them, he brings them back first to Peniel, and he marches them in front of the elders and he says, "Look, here are the men that I was chasing. I did what I was supposed to do. I did what I was asked and tasked to do. now I'm going to do what I told you that I was going to do. And he gathers everybody, every man in Peniel in the tower, and he tears it down and kills every single one of them. And he marches his 300 men and the two kings, Ziba and Zalmunna, to Succoth. And he marches them in front of the elders and he says, here they are. The two men that I promised that I would bring you, here they are. And also, here are the brambles and thorny branches that I promised that I was going to bring you with and beat you to. And he did. Beat the elders of the city of Succoth within an inch of their lives. And then he turns to the kings of the Midianites. Says, now it's your turn. You've seen how I operate and what I do. And now it's your turn. But I'm not going to give you the honor of dying by mine own hand. And he turns to this little boy. We're not sure if it's one of his sons or one of his slaves or a sword bearer or what. And he gives his sword to this little boy and he says, kill him, kid. And the kid kind of locks up. He freezes. He's like, ugh. And the kings, they say, be a man, the text says. Be a man and kill us yourself. It's like, no, the kid's going to do it. And they're like, no. If you were a real man, you would kill us yourself. There's this interesting exchange, and Gideon takes the sword from the little boy, and he is the one who destroys the kings, Ziba and Zalmunna, and with it, the entire nation of Israel. Something happened in Gideon's life between his gracious response to the Ephraimites and his not-so-gracious response to the men of Succoth and Peniel. Something happened there, and we're not sure what. Maybe he's just tired. Maybe he's grumpy. Maybe he's hungry. I don't know what it is, but something happened in his life where we see a gracious response backed up by an incredibly ungracious response. Here's how Israel responds. The Israelites said to Gideon, be our king. You, your son, your grandsons, you be our rulers, for you have destroyed and rescued us from Midian. It's the first time in the entire Bible that we see the nation of Israel offer its kingship to a person. It's not the last time, because in Samuel, the nation of Israel gathers together again and they tell Samuel, we don't want God to be our king anymore. We want a real king like everybody else. God grants their wish through a series of exchanges and Saul becomes their king, and we know how that goes. This is the first time that Israel offers for God not to be their king anymore, and for a man to be their king. Gideon says, I will not rule over you, and neither will my son. The Lord will rule over you. Good job, Gideon, right? Great response, Gideon. However, if I could make one request, could you just bring to me one earring from the plunder that you collected from your fallen enemies? The Ishmaelites, Midianites, Ishmaelites, same, right? And the way that they distinguished themselves from other people was by wearing these big, thick gold hoop earrings, right? And so you keep count of how many soldiers you destroyed by collecting their earrings. It's kind of like the plunder, right? And so he says, I don't want both earrings. I just want one. Just bring one of those earrings to me. And it says that he collected 43 pounds of gold earrings. Because the people, gladly, it says, gladly they replied. And we're like, oh, that's nice. But do you remember what happened the last time Gideon didn't get what he asked for? Well, he tore down their tower and he murdered a bunch of people and he beat them. So I'm not 100% sure that people are like, yeah, gladly, we'll give it to you. But I'm sure it's like, okay, yeah, we were there. We saw what you did the last time. You didn't get what you asked for. Here you go, Gideon. So here's what's happening here, right? Israel says to Gideon, we want you to be our king. Gideon says, I won't. God is your king. Good job, Gideon. but he taxes them. Well, who has the authority to establish taxes? Kings do, of course, right? So Gideon rejects the title, but immediately begins to act like a king. The text goes on. It says that he takes the gold and he melts it down, and he made a sacred ephod of the gold, and he put it in Ophrah. And soon all of the Israelites prostituted themselves by worshiping the ephod, and it became a trap to Gideon and to his family. Let me explain to you what an ephod here is real quick, because it's easy to miss if you don't understand the language. While the Israelites are wandering out in the desert, God gives them a very specific set of instructions for how he expects to be worshipped. He establishes for them their festivals and their holy days and the procedures and processes for the way in which they go about worshiping him. And not only that, but he also, because God cares and takes very seriously the way in which we worship him, he sets up all of these rules and regulations for the temple and the tabernacle and all of the artifacts that go in it, for how to build the Ark of the Covenant, how to build these wells and these torches and all of these things that create this worshipful environment in the temple. And then he says, okay, but not only that, I also care about what you wear when you're worshiping me. And so your high priest, he needs to wear this. And he gives them a very rigid set of instructions for the type of clothes that the high priest is supposed to wear. And one of the things that the high priest is supposed to wear is this little medallion called an ephod. It's made out of gold, and it's got these two coins inside of it that you could kind of blink, blink, pop out, right? And they would use them to communicate with God. And I know that this sounds weird, right? This is going to sound strange, but this is the way that God set things up. I want you to think about the ephod like you think about the magic eight balls. Remember those? Does my next-door neighbor have a crush on me? The details are murky. Yes, I agree. That's why I'm asking you. Do I get extra dessert for dinner tonight? Yes. Yes. Right. Magic eight ball. Here's what they would do with the ephod. They'd punch these little coins out, two identical coins, and they'd flip them both at the same time. Say, God, are we going to win this battle? Bling! And if they both land heads up, well, that's a yes. If they both land heads down, well, that's a no. And if they land 50-50, well, that is, the details are murky. And I know that this sounds weird, but this is the way that God set himself up to communicate with the nation of Israel. And the thing is, and I haven't done a big study on this, but we don't see the ephod being used hardly at all. Like, I had to look up kind of what it was and how it functioned, because it didn't necessarily, it's just not referenced a bunch. So I know that it sounds weird. Just trust me and believe me, and you can go back and read it yourself if you want to in Exodus and Numbers and Leviticus and all of those books about the ephod. You can go and read it for yourself. But here's what is happening. This holy device, sanctioned and sanctified by God to communicate with him, that only the high priest is supposed to wear, Gideon makes his own. From the gold that he collected as a tax from his people. And then he moves the religious center of Israel to his hometown. It says, he put the ephod, the way to communicate with God, in Ophrah, which, if you'll remember from Gideon, from Judges chapter 6, is his hometown. So he says, I'm not going to be your king, but I am going to take taxes from you, and I'm going to relocate your religious center, and I am going to set it up in such a way that only I can communicate with God. The text tells us that Gideon has 70 sons, multiple wives, 70 sons, which back in the day, not the wildest thing to hear. There are other judges who have lots of sons as well. Polygamy was just a thing back then, and that's just how it operated. And if it was only 70 sons, that we could get away with it. But it's his 71st son that I that's problematic, right? His 71st son is named Abimelech. And he's not from one of Gideon's wives. He's from one of Gideon's concubines. Does anybody know what Abimelech means? The name Abimelech that Gideon gives to his 71st son means, "My father is king." So Gideon says, "I'm not going to be a king. The Lord is your king, but I'm going to set up taxes, and I'm going to relocate the religious center, and I'm going to have all the power and all the authority, and I'm going to name my 71st son, my father is king." Spoiler alert, after Gideon dies, all 71 sons are trying to figure out who's in charge, and baby Abimelech, he's not a baby anymore, but he says, "We can't operate with 71 rulers." So he kills all 70 of his brothers, and he assumes leadership. And it does not go well, right? The text says that there's 40 years of peace in Israel. And what it means by that is that there's 40 years where they're not oppressed by another nation. But during those 40 years, they're oppressed by themselves. We enter into the civil war period of Israel where Abimelech just wreaks havoc on the nation of Israel. And it's only when some lady drops a millstone on his head from a tower that he's trying to burn down that Abimelech dies. And then we get Jephthah, which Jake gets to talk about next week. And that's a mess too. I told you that we're operating here in typology, that this looks like that, but the opposite. Isaac, can you put that picture up for me? Here's Gideon. I'm not going to be king, for God is king of Israel. But pay me taxes. And let's relocate all of the power to my hometown. I will be the person through whom you communicate on behalf of God. I am going to be promiscuous and proliferate and have multiple wives and 70 sons and concubines on the side. And I'm going to name my last son, my father is king. So don't you dare forget who I actually am and what I actually do. Typology functions in the negative. This looks like that, but the opposite. And what we see in the life of Gideon is somebody who rejects the title and assumes all of the benefits of being a king. And what we see in the life of Jesus, Isaac, if you could give me that next slide, in his interaction with Pilate, Pilate says, "Jesus, are you a king?" And Jesus says, "My kingdom's not of this world." Pilate says, "So you are a king then?" And you know what happens? Jesus never once denies being a king. It's why he ends up on a cross, because only kings end up on crosses. Want to be kings. It's not that Jesus denied being a king. It's the way Jesus defined being a king that fascinates me about him and about Gideon. Because Gideon said, "I'm not a king, but I'm going to act like it." And Jesus says, "I am a king, but I am a king different than any king you have ever seen before." Gideon relocated the center of power to his hometown. Jesus didn't have a home. Gideon said, "You can only communicate to God through me." Jesus says, "You can talk to God whenever you want, however you want. You don't need the high priest. You don't need the temple. You just talk to God. Here's how to pray." Gideon said, "I'm going to take your taxes." Jesus said, "Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's." Gideon had a lot of wives and a lot of kids. Jesus was celibate. Gideon was arrogant and prideful, and Jesus, on the last night of his life, threw a feast for his friends, and he assumed the lowest role in the room in washing his disciples' feet. And we are like, "Oh, feet are gross. They smell." It's like, yeah, they do, but also in the ancient world, they're dirty, and they're probably covered in animal urine and feces because you just dump that stuff out in the roads. And by the way, you probably do that with your own feces and urine too, right? And so we're not just dealing with like dusty, sweaty feet. We're dealing with like dusty, sweaty, feces and urine covered feet. That's the role that Jesus took. Gideon said, I'm not going to be your king, but I'm going to act like your king. Jesus said, I am your king, and I'm going to show you how a king ought to act. And I told you in week one, I hate the life of Gideon. Because every time I look at the life of Gideon, I see myself reflected in it. And again, this week, friends, I hate the life of Gideon, because for all of the times that Gideon said, I'm not your king, and acts the same, like he is, I see myself doing the same thing. I'm not king. God's king. But I'm going to build my own kingdom. I'm going to do me and do what's right by me. I'm going to make sure that I get mine. And yeah, I'll go to church on Sundays and I'll worship and, you know, I'll even preach a message occasionally. But for the most part, I'm in the kingdom building business. Jesus wants us to be in the kingdom building business. Like, don't miss me on that. But Jesus wants us to be in the business of building his kingdom. And his kingdom looks different than any kingdom we've ever seen. That's why his response to Pilate isn't, my kingdom's not of this world, my kingdom's up in heaven. No, his response to Pilate literally means, my kingdom does not look like what you expect it to look like. So I hate the life of Gideon, because every time I look at the life of Gideon, I see my own life. Even here, in his ruling and reigning, even when it looks like he's doing the right thing, I won't be your king, God's your king. Great job, Gideon. Friends, we have a king. We are part of a kingdom. And that king and that kingdom looks and operates different than anything that we've ever seen or experienced before. And all that king asks of us is to stop building our own kingdom and work to build his. My question for you this morning is, whose kingdom are you building? When you build Jesus' kingdom, there are so many rewards in the here and the now and also in the future. You start building your own kingdom, things go haywire. Start building your own kingdom, people literally die. Start building your own kingdom and it becomes a trap for you. It says Gideon was trapped by the ephod and the power that he thought that it gave to him. When you build your own kingdom, people get hurt. But when you build the kingdom of Jesus, friends, people get healed. And I can't think of a better result than that. So, God, would you help us to remember who's our king? Would you help us to remember what kingdom we're supposed to be building? Thank you for the life of Gideon and for the lessons that are there. Thank you for his faithfulness, for his willingness to do what you've called him to do, even though it took a while. Thank you for the negative example that he is. That we can look to him and say, oh, don't do that, do this instead. God, may we learn from the life of Gideon that our might doesn't come from our means, it comes from our mission. God, that we don't have to fight for victory, we get to fight from victory. And that the only kingdom worth building is your kingdom, not our own. When we build our own kingdoms, people get hurt. And when we build your kingdom, people get healed. May we be an active part of that healing process this week. Thanks for Jesus, and it's in his name that we pray. Amen. Friends, we're glad that you're here this morning. Let me encourage you, go ahead and read Judges chapter 9 on your own, just if for no other reason than that you're caught up for next week. Jake's going to start in Judges chapter 10, verse 6, I believe, and talk to us about Jephthah. Buckle up, it's a mess, right? I told you that there are no happy endings in Judges. That, man, it gets worse and worse and worse and worse, and it really begins to decline quickly with Jephthah. There's a lot to learn next week, so go ahead and do that. If you have questions or if you need prayer or anything like that, I'm up here, and we've got some elders and their wives up here at the front as well that would love to pray with you and talk with you, answer any questions that you may have. We love you guys a lot, and we're really thankful that you come here every single week, and we hope that you'll come back next week. Thanks. Have a great week. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out a worship experience here at Washington Avenue Christian Church. We're so glad that you chose to carve out part of your weekend to spend with us. And we would love to know that you were here watching with us online. So would you take just a moment, head over to our website, wacconline.org, and fill out the digital connect card there. You can let us know that you were here. You can let us know any next steps that you may be interested in taking, including but not limited to placing your faith in Jesus for the very first time. You can also let us know about anything that we can be praying about for you and with you. And I will be following up with you later on this week about those connect cards. Again, we're so glad that you chose to be with us for this worship experience at Washington Avenue Christian Church, where real people experience real grace.